What I wanted you to do is I wanted you to show you a story of a young person that we've been working with who struggled with something that a lot of people struggle with but don't ever talk to anyone about it. So this is Beth's story. Check it out.
When I first self-harmed, it wasn't a bad thing. At the time, I didn't really know what it was doing, but I knew it was doing something. I think I needed someone at that point to turn around and tell me it was going to be okay, and I didn't have anyone to tell me that at the time. I was born and brought up here on Regent's Park Estate. I was about 13 or 14, and I saw this massive purple bus on the estate, and it had XLP plastered along the front. So what is this? Let's go and check it out. I was completely shocked to find that the bus inside was not like a normal bus. There was a kitchen, there was seats, Xboxes, places to do homework, learn to cook. So we was like, oh, this is really cool, and kept coming back. I went to school in South London. It was quite a good school. Every student had to like hit that grade and they would really, really push you. And I knew I was gonna struggle when it came up to GCSEs. It was a lot of pressure to do my family proud, to do myself proud. And at the time I thought I couldn't talk to people about what was going on. When GCSEs came around and I didn't pass everything, I wasn't offered a place at sixth form. It felt really horrible. I felt like I'd completely failed. So I ended up really getting in my head about it and started self-harming. The first memory I have was burning my arms with deodorant cans, and then very quickly it moved on to cutting. My mum was the first person who realised, and at the time I don't think they knew what to do, so the first thing they did was they called my school up. And I remember going into school the next day, and the words they said to me was, you need to stop doing this because you're only doing it for attention, there's nothing wrong, you're fine. I went home that night and cut my arm up again. I remember thinking, I have no control of what's going on at all. And this is the one thing that I have control of. I didn't talk to the XLP leaders straight away. I'd known them for about 2 years by that point, but I still felt like this is my problem. It was only when we kind of got invited on our summer camp that I really thought, oh, they are going to stick around. Maybe it is worth me talking to them. We have a campfire every evening. We got a leader called Mary, was running the bus. And I remember Mary coming over to me at the time. She said, would you like to talk around the fire this year? I remember shaking top to toe as I got up. And I laid it all out in front of all of the people that were on the trip. Mary came and gave me a hug afterwards. And I was crying. She was like, you know what, if you ever need to have like a chat, I'm here. I remember that feeling of relief. It wasn't somebody who was judging me, telling me it was for attention. It was someone who was helping me try and find different methods of coping with the stress and letting me know that I wasn't a failure. Like, really trying to break the mindset that I'd given myself. I'm now on the XLP experience year, which is a gap year. I'm a leader on the bus that I first went to as a young person, which is really awesome. And I think through the experience that I've had, I know what it feels like to be there and feel like you're not worth anything. And actually, I could be the person to be like, you are worth millions, and I'm getting to be that person that Mary was for me to somebody else. And that's all because XLP helped me out.
What a fantastic story. And Beth... And she's here somewhere, so I'm going to embarrass her now. So here's the photo of Beth getting a certificate from yours truly. And just a couple of weeks ago, Beth has been on our gap year. Our gap year is before anyone between 18 and 100 who just wants to serve the communities of inner city London. Now, this seminar is called Honesty Over Silence. And, you know, Beth there on the video talked about a massive issue about self-harm, which is really common. But again, we don't tend to talk about that often. And anxiety and depression are those type of subjects as well. Who here has ever done this? You get a headache, you get a stomach ache, and you go to Dr. Google for a diagnosis. Has anyone ever done that? You know, suddenly you think, oh my goodness, and I'm going to self-diagnose. And you come up with the worst disease known to man. And you say to your mum or dad or your brother and sister, look, I'm dying. And they're like, you're not dying, just go to the doctor. I remember about 14 years ago now, just to be really honest with you guys, I had these pins and needles going down my arms like this and in my hands. And I'd just finished an XLP prayer meeting. And I remember going up to the lady who's sort of like the nurse and sort of looked after us all and went, "Yeah, I'm not feeling too good." And she went, "Oh, no, you'll be fine. It'll be fine." Next day, still not feeling too good. And so Di, my wife, was like, "Just go to A&E. I'm sure it'll be nothing." And so I went to A&E. And then you sit there, don't you, for like about 20 hours. In fact, I think I went in June and I got seen at Christmas time or something like that. You know, I sat there for a very, very long time. And that whole time, you're thinking worst case scenario. You're thinking, I'm going to have a heart attack. I'm going to have a heart attack now. And suddenly, the nurse calls your name and they did that thing where they test your heart. And then she looks at it and she goes, I think that's okay. What do you mean you think it's okay? You know, you want certainty. And then actually, I had all these tests. And then this wonderful consultant came up to me and went, "Have you got a stressful job?" And I was like, "Yeah, it could be stressful. I run a charity." And she was like, like this. And just sent me away. But then, as someone that was starting to struggle with anxiety, I got diagnosed about 9 years with a degenerative knee condition, which means I need to have both my legs broken in three places and have an external frame put around my leg with metal going through it. And I need to have this frame on where basically it has different struts on it where someone turns the struts and stretches me. My wife has to stretch me every single day. In fact, this is what it looked like up there. So this was me about a year ago. That's why I wasn't at Soul Survivor. Now, you can imagine, as someone who struggles with anxiety, this wasn't particularly good news for me. And it was also at a time where everything else was going wrong in my life. Kezia, my daughter, was very sick. Abigail, my other daughter, she broke her leg a couple of weeks before the operation. In fact, this is a picture of us on our Zimmer frames. And we've got the Zimmer frame picture, Mike, please. Mike? And there we are. There's Abigail, and there's me, and there's my son, Caleb. In fact, we had a race with the Zimmer frames down to the end of the garden. And my son, the one who hasn't broken his legs, won. And, you know, it was just getting all too much. And I was crying out to God, "What is going on?" My anxiety was getting out of control. So when I was going through this stage, I wrote this book called When Faith Gets Shaken, and you know, you can get if you want. And it just told story upon story about struggling with issues around anxiety, getting incredibly low. And I noticed that people just started emailing me and Facebooking me and tweeting me and just telling me their stories. And they're going, "You know what? I've never told anyone this before. All these Christian guys never told anyone this before." And then me and my mate, Andy, we went on tour. We've done three tours, When Faith Gets Shaken tours. We went all over the UK. In fact, in March next year, if anyone's interested in booking us, we're doing the whole thing again. So we would have done 40 shows by the time we finished the next tour. And the biggest issue was anxiety. People just kept coming up to me time and time again. And you see, the thing is this, anxiety is actually normal. It's a bit like a car alarm. You know, we need a car alarm. It tells people when they're nicking our car. But actually, what anxiety does, it sends the car alarm off all the time. And so that's why we need to learn to be able to control anxiety. We need to be able to talk about our mental health the way we talk about our physical health. We care about our physical health so much more. You know, back in the day, people didn't care about their physical health and they got diseases. You know, we clean our teeth because we've got to look after our teeth, otherwise we get tooth decay. But actually, we need to look after our mind and our emotional health as well. And sometimes, when you're caring for your mental health or you suffer from anxiety, depression, sometimes Christians go, "You know, pull yourself together. It's all in your mind." I mean, imagine saying to someone with a broken leg, "Pull yourself together. It's all in your leg." You know, you've got to be stronger. Walk it off. We wouldn't dream of doing that. But evidence now suggests that actually a bigger killer than cigarettes is loneliness. Loneliness is actually killing more people. You see, it's okay not to be okay. I use this illustration quite a lot. If we break a pot here in the UK, what we do is we tend to mend it with superglue, yeah? And the whole idea of mending it with superglue is you pretend that the cracks aren't there. And we pretend it's okay. In Japan, what they do is they put a gold powder in the glue. And they call it kintsugi art. And by putting a gold powder in the glue, they basically make a feature of the cracks. Arguably, it becomes more beautiful than it was before. God doesn't want us to hide our scars.
actually, he wants to say, I want to work with you. If you suffer from anxiety, you are not on your own. The fact is this, is one in four people in the UK will experience a mental health problem. One in six people experience a common health mental problem, such as anxiety and depression, in any given week. And you will know if you suffer from anxiety, sometimes it can feel like you're just falling and you're falling and you're falling and you're trying to find something to hold on to and you just can't. My mate, who is a very high up in the police, he said for him, is like if you imagine a cat in a bath, not that it's got any water in it, but if you imagine a cat in a bath and it's scrambling to get out and it just can't get out, but the look of terror on its face is huge. I've heard so many talks on anxiety, depression. To be honest, a lot of them just go over my head because they're very technical. So I really wanted to try to break down what anxiety could look like for maybe some of you guys. So maybe check some of these out. Anxiety is your brain not being able to turn off. Anxiety is the unanswered text message that kills us inside, particularly WhatsApp, because you can tell that they've seen the text message and they haven't replied. What's wrong with these people? It believes every negative scenario that you can come up with. It's the inaccurate conclusion draws as your mind takes off and you have no choice but to follow its lead. It's apologizing for things that you don't even require you to say sorry. It's self-doubt and a lack of confidence. It's trying to fix something that isn't a problem. It's the fear of failure and striving for protection, then beating yourself up when you don't get there. It tells you that you're wrong. They don't like you. It's consistently asking yourself the what if questions. This is the best definition that I've seen of anxiety. It says this. But more than anything else, anxiety is caring. It's never wanting to hurt someone's feelings. It's never wanting to do something wrong. More than anything, it's the want and need simply to be accepted and liked. So you can try too hard at times. I love these little cartoons here. This is anxiety. What if nobody likes me? What if I taste weird? What if I'm too cold? What if I'm too hot? What if I'm just right and I can never live up to it again? The perils of overthinking. Help, I've made a mistake. What do people think of me? Am I good enough? Am I doing the right job? I'm doing wrong. Everyone's staring at me. Why do I bother? Why? Who overthinks things so much of the time? It becomes a habit. It becomes an addiction, and it's like wave after wave after wave it comes. And what happens is when we perceive a threat, and sometimes it may not even be a real threat, it may be a threat in our head. Someone in the youth group doesn't like us. Then our body actually goes into what's called fight response. So what happens is this, is you look at the screen, it says the ears and the eyes sense a threat. The information is passed on to the brain. And then the brain goes on red alert and it tells the adrenaline glands on the top of the kidneys to release extra adrenaline into the blood vessels, and then blood vessels carry the adrenaline around the body. So suddenly that is issued, I guess, in your body, and you are almost at that point a little bit out of control. You know, the thing about anxiety is that the way to get rid of it is to accept uncertainty. I use lots of quotes on the way. I know that I do that, and I have lots of little things. So I've made a copy of some of them, but there are more people here than I thought. So if you want a copy of the quotes that I'm using, if you come up to us at the end, I can give you a free copy of all the different quotes that I'm using, if that's okay. Can I go back to Chloe's quote? Is that okay, Mike? Sorry, I'm mucking you around here. This is another brilliant quote. It says this: some of us find it hard to surrender because it seems like giving up, but sometimes letting go means regaining control, and giving up the struggle is the most empowering thing we can do. If we're trying to control things all the time and it hasn't been working for you, isn't it time to do something else? You see, we can get hypersensitive about lots of things. Now, most anxiety, people say, can be traced back to two different things. I wonder if you know what they are. Number one is, a lot of people, if we're honest, we're scared of death. Most health-related anxiety goes back to being scared of death, scared of dying. How often does a headache become a brain tumor? How often does something happen and then it just escalates in our brain? But the second thing most of us are scared of is approval. Is actually one of our fundamental needs is we need to be loved and we need to be cared for. And so often what we do is we seek other people's opinion. Words can really, really hurt us. And then it enforces that hidden belief that you think about yourself, that you are worthless and you are not enough. Fear becomes an illusion that feels really, really real. This is a great way to describe fear. Fear, F-E-A-R, false evidence appearing real. I remember hearing the story of a guy who was in the desert and it was really, really hot, been there for ages, and he looked down and he thought what he saw was a snake. Brain goes in, fight or flight thing goes into his adrenaline, starts pumping around his body, and he thinks, I'm going to get attacked by a snake. And he looks at it, actually, it's a rope. How often do we go through situations think, oh my goodness, it's a disaster? And 99% of the time, it isn't. It's false evidence appearing real. But the bulk of it is this. Anxiety says that you're not enough. I'm going to show you a little bit video now. This is a person talking about what anxiety feels like to her. Check it out. I like the last bit that says the first step is by looking at it head on and calling it for what it is. One of the ways to cope with anxiety is actually to admit that you have it. It's interesting, this quote that I find is really interesting. It says, depression, anxiety, and panic attacks are not a sign of weakness. They're a sign of trying to remain strong for too long. There's a psychiatrist, and he said basically he looks after people that suffer from depression. And I guess there's people here today who suffer from depression and anxiety, otherwise you probably wouldn't be here. And sometimes that people that suffer from depression, it's sort of seen as a weak thing. And one of the things that he was saying is that he can work out the characteristics of someone that suffers from depression almost before he meets them. Because he said, actually, people that suffer from depression are normally incredibly strong people. They've just been strong for too long. He says that the people that suffer from depression show these personal characteristics. I think this is really interesting. They are morally strong. They are reliable. They're diligent. They have a strong conscience. They have a strong sense of responsibility. They have a tendency to focus on the needs of others before their own. They're sensitive. They're vulnerable to criticism. And their self-esteem is dependent on the evaluation of others. And some of the most famous people in the world who've just done the most amazing things in the world have actually suffered from depression. Oliver Cromwell, Abraham Lincoln, Vince Van Gogh, Winston Churchill. And you know what? None of these people get together by other Christians telling them to pull themselves together and sort their life out. It doesn't help. Overcoming anxiety means that we need to manage it, otherwise it will manage us. So I want to look at just some couple ways of how do we do this. And I want to ask you four questions. And there's loads more else I could say, but these are four questions that are really helpful to ask yourself if you're suffering from a bit of anxiety. Number one is, how do you show self-compassion? Because the last thing you need if you suffer from anxiety is a big dose of guilt because you're suffering from anxiety. Because you'll think you've got to trust in God. You know, Elijah is an interesting example in the Bible. Elijah was one of those guys where life just didn't work out the way he wanted it to. And sometimes, you know, our prayers don't get answered. People do get ill. People do get cancer. Relationships do break down. Accidents happen. Redundancies are made. Test results come back with the most terrifying news. And you know, in 1 Kings 19 verse 4, Elijah says to God, I've had enough. Because he's had this big showdown at a place called Carmel where he's killed all these prophets of Baal. You know the story. And he thinks, this is it. He probably thought, I'm going to start my book tour now. This is going to be it. It's going to be fantastic. I'm going to speak at all the festivals. But actually, he goes into the depths of depression because things don't work out the way he thinks it's going to work out. Relationships, particularly, always breaking down is a big one for this. And God doesn't say to him, come on, mate, cheer up. Remember Carmel, that was pretty good, you know, and Zenopath and the Cherith Ravine, that was pretty good stuff. Remember the miracles? Elijah didn't get a pep talk because what he needed was compassion. So an angel was sent to take care for him tenderly. He was exhausted. He was knackered. And then he speaks to Elijah in one of the most intimate moments in the Bible. And he tells Elijah, you know what, Elijah? You are not on your own. Because often when we go for these things, it can be one of the most lonely parts of our lives, can't it? But you need to know that you're not on your own. That self-compassion isn't about an ego trip. It's about not beating yourself up consistently. It's taking a non-judgment stance at some of those thoughts that are coming into your head. So I'm here to tell you, if you suffer from anxiety, give yourself a break. Let yourself off the hook, stop beating yourself up, and give up the struggle. Accept that you have it. The other way people deal with anxiety is they just avoid it. They become those sort of very prickly type of characters that it's called avoidant attachment. I don't want to get too technical. We harden up. We don't let people see the real us. And all this does actually is maintain our anxiety, so we never learn to manage it. You know, I'm a weirdo because I have spoken in some of the most violent places in the world. I have spoken where people have got guns down the front of their trousers. I have spoken in maximum security prisons, both here in the UK and overseas. I've spoken in front of 70 million people on BBC World Service. All these things should make me feel anxious, really. But then I can come home from speaking at one of those things, have a headache and think, oh no, I've got a brain tumour. You know, suddenly it affects us all in different ways. And Christians can be really unhelpful, because sometimes if you say, I've got struggle with anxiety, they say, well, trust God. And you think to yourself, I never thought of that. Trust God, that's where I've been going wrong all these years. Just trust God, thank you very much. And you know, sometimes we just need to let ourselves off the hook. There's an amazing film called Good Will Hunting. Anyone seen Good Will Hunting? It's a brilliant film. You need to see it. It's great. At least two of you have seen it. It's great. And basically, Good Will Hunting is about a guy, Robin Williams' character, is basically a psychiatrist. And he's the guy with the beard. And Matt Damon's character is a maths genius, but he's really been struggling with stuff. And the psychiatrist basically shows him this picture of someone that's been abused. And he says, basically, see this? Do you know anything about this? And Matt Damon's character's been abused many times. He went, yeah, yeah, I know quite a lot about that, thanks. You? Yeah, I know quite a lot about that as well. And he looks at him and says, mate, see this? It's not your fault. He goes, yeah, I know. No, no, look at me, son. Look me in the eye, son. It's not your fault. He goes, I know. It's not your fault. I know. And then there's lots of swearing. But the thing is this, sometimes God looks at you. And you know, I've done this little Goodwill Hunting thing every time. And every time I see people's eyes filling up with tears, because people think that some of the stuff they've been through is all their fault. And you need to realize that some of the stuff, life happens, it's not your fault. It's not your fault. And actually, when you start to realize that and start showing self-compassion, then things start to change. The second question that I've got for you, who do you keep company with? We are built for community. I was going to use the word community, but it sort of gets overused in church these days, doesn't it? Everything's about community. Who do you keep company with? Who are the people you really understand? I want to show you this little clip. I think this is brilliant, because you know what? People that suffer from anxiety, they don't just want loads and loads of answers. They want people to come in and just share in their journey. Check this fantastic little video out by Brené Brown. Really, really good. Third question I want to ask you guys, do you ever monitor your thoughts? Who can relate to this next one, this next picture? Put the next one up, Mike. There you go. It's like positive, 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 negative. It's true, I'm a failure. It's so often people can say 100 positive things, say one negative thing, and what's the thing you're going to think about in bed tonight? It's going to be the one negative thing. There's a film, again, another film called Beautiful Mind. It's about this guy called John Nash, who was a maths genius. It was played by Russell Crowe. But he suffered from schizophrenia. He heard government officials telling him that he needed to break sovereign codes, causing him to have this major breakdown. But what happens in the film, he learns what's called the art of discernment. He learns which voices are true and which voices are false. And he turns to his friend in the film at one point and he goes, I don't think I'm that different to you. We all hear voices, we just have to decide which ones to listen to. You see, I hear the voice of comparison a lot. I come to Soul Survivor and speak a lot of festivals, and I look at the program and I see whose seminars are on at the same time as mine. And I think, oh my goodness, they're funnier than I am, they've got amazing stories of people getting healed more than I have, God uses them more than I have, and I just want to find the sat-nav and go home, to be honest. And that imposter syndrome then goes like, everything that I've ever achieved in my life is a fluke. And one day I'm going to be found out. Maybe this afternoon's the afternoon that I get found out. I get the critical voice. Oh my goodness, you've failed again. What is wrong with you? You've let yourself down. You should be able to cope. And what we do is, instead of having flexible goals, we have these really, really strict goals. And if we don't meet these goals, then we're in trouble. The voice that says, I'm not enough. We need to listen to a different voice. We need to listen to the voice of Jesus, the voice of love and compassion that isn't going to put you down, that isn't going to make you guilty. And sometimes when you're in that negative zone, a really cool thing to do is say, actually, what would my friend think in this situation? See the situation through someone who loves you. So you see, your thoughts are opinions, they're not facts. Your mind is not always your friend. You need to start questioning the quieter voice. There's a way of dealing with this. There's a little diagram that I've put up here. It's basically, you get anxious for... ask why. Why am I thinking like this? Establish the real cause. Is it death? Is it people? And then actually you use the alternative voice to overcome the thought. Last thing before I finish is, last question. How grateful are you? This isn't denying that things are wrong, but it's finding within them that you can find something amazing that is going on. me and my wife, we have this thing, this rule, that every night we have to try and think of three things that we're grateful for, even if our days have been absolutely rubbish. And sometimes I don't really feel it, you know. She always turns over and says, "What are you grateful for?" I'm like, "My bed." What else are you grateful for? Sleep. But the thing is this, is actually gratitude is nature's solution to anxiety. When I wrote When Faith Gets Shaken, like I said, I was amazed by people's honesty and vulnerability. And I'm going to play some music with some really powerful words. And you're going to see some of the testimonies from that book. You're going to see them and see what God has done for his people. And then I'm going to share one last personal story, and then we're going to pray. Is that okay? Check this out. So, I don't know. This is my one. This was me. My brother died after 2 days. And he died a day before my birthday. And so every year when it came to my birthday, I didn't really want to celebrate it until a couple of years ago, because I just wanted my brother to be there. And it felt like I sort of missed out with that. So I didn't grieve at all for years. But I'm learning to now. And this was the other one. Everyone prayed for healing, but nothing happened. It's a bit pain in the neck being quite well known in the Christian world when you're quite ill, because everyone wants to pray for you every 5 seconds. And I've been prayed for by every famous Christian you could possibly imagine. But actually God met me in my pain and helped me deal with a lot of that stuff. The seminar's called Honesty Over Silence. And my prayer is, as I've really grappled with what to say today, my prayer is that those questions, that you really think about them. How compassionate are you to yourself? Who are you keeping company with? Do you monitor your thoughts? How grateful are you? And I just wanted to encourage you so much to keep going, to allow God. You know, Nelson Mandela said this, "Don't judge me by my success. Judge me by how many times I fell down and I got back up again." That's how we judge people. You know, allow God into those moments where actually they're pretty tough. There's one story, I'll finish with a story, is I was praying with someone once, and you know, God can do so many stuff, and there's so much in my past that I haven't shared with anyone and still won't share. But there's a few things that I will now. And I remember when I was about 11, 12, I was in PE, and I was actually really good at PE. I'm not particularly academic, but I was really good at PE. And it came to throw the discus. You know the discus? You know, it's that weird sort of thing you do in athletics. And the whole idea of a discus is that you're meant to hold it actually like this. And you're meant to spin round. And because you're spinning so fast, it's meant to keep somehow the discus in your hand. But I just could not do it. It makes no sense to me. What is this discus thing all about? Every time I held it and tried to do this, it would just flop on the floor. And I did it, and I did it again. And in the end, my PE teacher just absolutely lost it with me. And he got me in front of the class, and he shouted at me. And he screamed at me. And even the other PE teacher thought, this guy's really lost it this time. And I remember at the time just feeling completely and utterly humiliated. And I remember in front of all my kids, you'll know how embarrassing this was. I just stood there, and I started crying in front of the whole class. Now, the thing is, it must have been pretty bad, because the class, my mates, didn't even take the mickey out of me afterwards, which normally I would have got absolutely destroyed, because this guy was destroying me. And I remember one day I was talking to this person, they went, "Could you imagine Jesus coming into that situation? If you got in touch that situation again, tell me how it felt." So I told them how it felt. I felt humiliated. I felt isolated. Now, can you imagine Jesus coming into that situation? Now, to be honest, when people say that, I can never imagine Jesus. I always think of Jesus as like Jesus of Nazareth, Robert Powell, you know. I always think of him on the films, and I just can't imagine Jesus. But for once, I got it. I got that Jesus wanted to come into that situation. And he came into that situation, and he walked up to my PE teacher. And I thought, what is Jesus going to say? He turned to my PE teacher, and in my imagination, he just went, "Oi. That's my boy. That's my boy." He went, "Come on, Patrick, let's get out of here and play some football." And he took me away. And when I was within that situation, I felt safe and I felt celebrated and I felt that I belong. Sometimes when you're facing all this stuff that goes on, I can give you all the technical stuff, but ultimately you need to know that you belong. You've listened really, really well. I'm going to pray and let you guys get on with the day.